And now it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
If indeed there was some great conspiracy, it apparently didn't work since the county election official was Democrat lost and other Republicans won. What really happened, it came down to people split their ticket. People voted for Republicans down ballot, but they didn't vote for President Trump, Martha McSally. And so that's the reality. Just because that happened, it doesn't mean it's fraud.
Joe's ability to work across the aisle in a bipartisan fashion will help deal with a lot of this mistrust and everything else that's going on right now.
Dr. Chris and our public health officials have been telling us for several weeks that we are experiencing a new spike in COVID-19. And without serious changes from us, the adults making daily choices that determine the virus's path, we cannot expect these numbers to head in a safe direction.
Use your patio, open your windows and doors to increase ventilation. Reduce the size of your gathering to a smaller number than typical. You can use a tablet and virtual meeting programs to link multiple families together without exposing one another. And consider celebrating virtually with your college-age students or your higher risk and elderly relatives.
And with us to talk about ballot counting lawsuits, non-concessions, and more are Lorna Romero, owner of Elevate Strategies. Lorna, good morning.
Good morning.
And attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Roy, let me start with you, because a few weeks before the election, we had you on, and we discussed a bit election lawsuits and whether both parties were sort of getting their attorneys ready to go just in case that happened. Well, we're seeing it, but we're seeing it in a way that may be an extension that a lot of people are saying, this is not exactly the Florida of 2000. This is just one president pursuing some things that may or may not be kosher. What's your general take on it?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen nationally, and we've all seen this in the news, a number of lawsuits, a slew of lawsuits filed by Republicans in the Trump campaign related to elections, either elections administration or the actual counting of the ballots. And I think what we've seen nationally is that all of these lawsuits have either been dismissed because of a lack of merit or ultimately involve only, a limited number of ballots that would not actually affect the outcome of the election. And so we've seen that in other states. So one does have to sort of wonder what the sort of point is, what the strategy is nationally for all of that litigation. But again, I'm not surprised, given that Trump himself, has not certainly not conceded, but certainly not, look like he's accepted the results of the election yet.
Lorna, in our state yesterday in court, Corey Langhofer, who was representing the Trump side on this one, said we're not alleging anyone stealing the election. That's just not our theory here. The allegation is here in the what appears to be a limited number of cases. There were good faith errors in operating the machine that result in further review of certain ballots. So is this really, in some cases, just sort of pursuing the whim of one campaign as opposed to really proving voter fraud, or do you think there's something there?
I don't think that there's anything there when it comes to voter fraud. And as specifically, like you mentioned, the number of ballots that are even being up for debate, if there was some type of error, is so minimal. And so this is really just the Trump campaign trying to take every opportunity or every chance to say that there is mass fraud when there's no evidence of that, or to try to turn or change the final outcome of the election, which is not going to happen. And so in my personal opinion, I agree with my colleague, Roy, this is a waste of time. And to move forward with these types of lawsuits is doing more damage to the overall process when, especially in a state like Arizona, we handled the counting of these ballots significantly well with a large turnout in such a short period of time.
Lorna, does it undercut either legally or maybe just sort of in the court of public opinion, some of the arguments the Trump campaign is making when somebody like Attorney General Mark Brnovich goes on national TV and says he didn't think there was anything there and he just thought it was a matter of ballot splitting as opposed to any kind of fraud?
Well, I guess you could say it undercuts it, but the Attorney General is being honest and upfront with the voters of Arizona and the American people about what the reality is in the state. And it's not what President Trump is saying. The reality is that people did not vote for President Trump. People did not vote for Martha McSally, but then they actually voted for Republicans down ballot. And so to make this allegation that somehow, that there was some conspiracy against him, and against Republicans, you would see Republicans across the entire state down ballot having the same argument as the president. But that's not the reality. They were actually reelected. And so it just comes down to the president having to accept the results that happened here in Arizona and other states.
Yeah, Roy, a number of people have made the point that if there was some conspiracy, the guy whose job it is to oversee the election in Maricopa County wouldn't have lost his race, which Adrian Fontes did and conceded this week. Given, as both you and Lorna have talked about, how this really doesn't, there doesn't seem to be a lot of legal basis to the claims that the Trump campaign has made. It seems to be sort of a public opinion kind of thing. What kind of impact do you think Mark Brnovich saying what he said could ultimately have?
Well, I think he deserves a lot of credit for saying what he said. I think it took an amount of courage to say that, because certainly there's people that are in his party that are sort of alleging things that are very different and that are untrue. But I think the bottom line is that this idea that there is, you know, election fraud or voter fraud here in Arizona is just baseless. And I think that's true, you know, throughout the country. So I'm, you know, glad to hear that the Attorney General agrees that that hasn't occurred here. The bottom line is that the state of Arizona, I think Lorna, you know, alluded to this, has a really, you know, one of the best and most smoothly run elections in the country. I mean, and I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, a good set of laws that we have here that are clear and easy to follow and understand and comprehensive, but also because we have election administrators that do a really good job, from the Secretary of State down to the county recorders and boards of supervisors. And so the elections here run very smoothly. And I think that's what we saw in this election, where we didn't experience the kind of problems that I think some folks on the Republican side are, I think, falsely alleging.
Well, let me pursue one thing you said, though, and this is very much a political question. And the Attorney General is one of our favorite guests because he's so plain spoken most of the time. But does this put us in a position where, you know, he's getting credit for saying something that, you know, is good, that many other people are not saying? But should that be, you know, sort of a bright line for us to think about why some other people in the state are not saying the same thing? During the campaign, Governor Ducey actually said to President Trump in his presence, no, we do it right in Arizona, mail-in balloting works here, but we're not really hearing from the governor or other folks at this point.
That's right, and that's disappointing. I mean, I think, you know, if this was the perfect world, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, because I think everyone would sort of recognize what the truth is about how, you know, again, how our elections are run. But you know, it is a political question. And, you know, I think you may see some Republicans that are perhaps scared to say anything that may seem to contravene perhaps what Trump is saying in D.C. And so it's unfortunate that some people aren't saying that, where I have to sort of praise Attorney General for, I think, just doing kind of the bare minimum. But I still think it is important that he did it.
Lorna, let me get your take on that, on the Attorney General and beyond. You know, sometimes we will admit this, sometimes in media, we do not try to drum up things. I certainly never have. But there's a situation where, okay, is this going to be a divide with Republicans, just as we talk about some of these Democrats are going to have a divide? Is there going to be a divide deeper than we've already seen among folks like Mark Brnovich as compared to Andy Biggs or Paul Gosar?
You know, I don't think it's, obviously there's an existing divide. I mean, that's no secret in the Republican Party. And I think we experienced that with the election results here in Arizona. So I don't think it's going to further that. But I do agree with Roy that I am disappointed that more Republicans are not speaking out against the tactics and the allegations of the president, because it draws unnecessary criticism to the our underlying foundation as a democracy of having free and fair elections. And so to make this allegation that just because you didn't win, it must be because of this vast conspiracy or a bunch of fraud with no evidence pointing to that, and having your supporters believe that is extremely unfortunate. So I am proud of Attorney General Brnovich for speaking up. I do agree with Roy that, I mean, it should just be common practice right now for Republicans and Democrats, independents, whomever, to, especially in the state of Arizona, to say that, no, this is just not accurate. And I hope that people will continue to speak up, since Attorney General Brnovich has.
Lorna, why do you think more Republicans haven't spoken up about this?
You know, and that's a really good question. I wonder the same thing as well, because I don't think that there's going to be any kind of repercussion to that. I mean, there's no way Trump is coming back from this. There is no path to victory for him. So I could understand 4 to 6 months ago of fear amongst some Republicans of speaking out against the president because it would impact them in some way, whether he would attack them on Twitter personally, say something negative about them at a rally, they would lose support from their base. But moving forward, we are transitioning to a new president. And so for Republicans not to speak up about something that is so fundamental to us as a democracy and as a society is very disappointing.
So, Lorna, let's move down the ballot one slot from the presidential race to the U.S. Senate race. Senator-elect Mark Kelly is working out of temporary office space in D.C. that he has been assigned. You know, we've talked about President Trump not conceding the election. Senator Martha McSally also really, not only has she not conceded the election, she hasn't really said much of anything other than a Veterans Day message on social media since the election. I'm curious what you make of her silence and her not really acknowledging the results of this election.
Yeah, this is another one where we put this in the category of things that don't make sense in 2020, which I think we all pretty have extensive lists of that for this
That's
year.
A long one.
Yes.
And it's a long one. So let's just add it to the list. Again, I mean, Martha McSally was in an even worse position than the president in Arizona when it came to, you know, her ability to be successful, you know, in those days post, you know, the election with the additional ballots being counted. And so the fact that she's gone radio silent, the fact that she has not conceded the race, it's kind of embarrassing, to be honest. I mean, ballots are pretty much done being counted at this point. And as you, as the sitting U.S. senator, to not concede and congratulate your opponent and start the transition, it's unfortunate. And why she's staying silent, I don't know. I don't know if there's a Trump impact involved in this or what, but my recommendation is that Senator Martha McSally concede and start that transition process over to our new U.S. Senator-elect.
Roy, there's been a theory, and Lorna referenced it as a possibility, that this is related to President Trump and his reluctance to concede, and maybe the idea that this could somehow impact the runoff elections for U.S. Senate in Georgia coming up in January. What do you think is behind Senator McSally's reluctance or just reticence to say anything and to concede here?
Well, I mean, I have to believe, if I had to guess, it's something like that, where she is essentially just following Trump's lead here in refusing to concede. I don't know whether she, you know, she would actually believes that it would result in any kind of change in the outcome, but certainly that's what the posture that she's following. And it's really disappointing. I mean, we certainly talk about the peaceful transfer of power, you know, at the presidential level and why that makes this country so unique in comparison to others in special. But, you know, transfer of power with other offices is important too. And right now, you know, Senator-elect Kelly is getting his office up and running. And, you know, at this point, you know, Senator McSally should have conceded, should have called Senator-elect Kelly and conceded and then started working together to try to get the transition going. And I juxtapose this a bit with what we saw at the county level with Adrian Fontes. I know we may talk about that, but, you know, there we saw somebody who, you know, realized the finality of the outcome of the election and conceded, called his opponent, and is now working with his opponent on that transfer of power. And that's what I think we should all expect from Senator McSally, but we have not seen it, and it's really disappointing.
One question for both of you before we go to break, and Roy, let me start with you. Regardless of whether they sort of ran more as independents rather than Democrats, they were certainly Democrats on the ballot. How significant is it that Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema are two U.S. senators from Arizona, both Democrats? First time in about 70 years that's happened.
Well, it's very significant, and I couple that with how I felt last night when I finally saw CNN and NBC call the presidential race here in Arizona, because I finally feel a bit of finality in that race as well. I mean, as a Arizona Democrat, somebody who started knocking doors back in the early 2000s for Janet Napolitano, who has witnessed a lot of losses in the last 20 years, you know, finally seeing this happen is a really special moment to me. And I think it's notable, you know, when you're looking at who won here, Senator Sinema, Senator Kelly, Joe Biden, the kind of Democrats they are, right, which are, you know, problem solvers, people who are willing to work across the aisle. These are the kinds of Democrats that I think win here, and at least at the statewide level. So it's very encouraging, and it just shows the future of the state and how it's turned blue.
Yeah, Lauren, I'm not going to ask you to do a color designation here, but just let's talk about the two senators who will be Arizona senators at least for the next couple of years. Are these the kind of Democrats, as Roy indicated, that can win in Arizona, that are pragmatic, let's say, and a little bit more in the middle?
Oh, yeah, 100%. And we learned this in 2018 with Kyrsten Sinema's win, that she created the blueprint and the path forward for a statewide Democrat to be successful in Arizona. And that's to really market yourself as independent. I mean, Kyrsten never mentioned she was a Democrat during her campaign, but really focusing on Arizona and being independent minded. And I think that is just a general sentiment that's always resonated with Arizona. I mean, even with Republican leaders like John McCain was very independent minded. And so, yes, they both might be Democrats, but I think they're exuding an underlying principle that Arizona voters respect and appreciate, which is that independence and that independent mindedness. And so I wouldn't go as far as my colleague to say that Arizona is necessarily blue. Yes, they're both Democrats, but I think it just goes to show Republicans and Democrats what it's going to take in terms of the quality and caliber of the candidate to be successful statewide, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat.
That's Lorna Romero, owner of Elevate Strategies, also with us, attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. With Mark Brody in Phoenix, I'm Steve Goldstein, in the midst of the Friday newscap, which continues after this. It's the Friday newscap on KJZZ 91.5 with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Our guests today, Lorna Romero and Roy Herrera.
Lorna, I want to ask you one more question before we move on about the U.S. Senate race. And, you know, 2 years ago when Senator Martha McSally lost her race to Kyrsten Sinema, it was a difficult race and kind of a not the most pleasant campaign, I think, for either candidate. She was generally seen as doing a very gracious job of posting the video with her dog conceding. And sort of the conventional wisdom at the time was that she was looking ahead to, you know, maybe the appointment, maybe running, the next time around. I'm wondering, given the fact that she has now lost two Senate races in two cycles, given what we've seen since Election Day, do you see a political future for Martha McSally in Arizona at this point?
That's a very good question. I mean, here's the thing. People have short memories in politics. I mean, I think we've all seen different stories and witnessed situations where we think nobody's going to be able to come back from this. And they do. So people typically have nine lives in politics. And second, she's still very young. So will she be successful running for another race in 2 to 4 years? Probably not. I would imagine that she probably goes into the private sector and, you know, builds her career a little bit more. And then maybe 10 years from now, she decides to run again, which she will still be pretty young at that point. So to say her political career is completely over, I think is a really bold statement, but I think it'll be wise for her to take a break for a little while.
All right. So let's move on even further down the ballot now. Roy, there had been a lot of hope among Democrats that this would be the cycle that they could flip one of the chambers of the Arizona legislature. This seems like it's been a conversation for at least a decade now that maybe the Democrats could win the Arizona House, maybe the Arizona Senate. In the end, despite all of the money, record levels of money that went into legislative races, there was a change of one seat in the state Senate for the Democrats. In your mind, what happened there?
Well, I mean, it's obviously disappointing and certainly not, I think, what was expected. I think most prognosticators, including myself, I think were wrong about what we were going to see or about what happened in the legislature. And I kind of have to amend a little bit of something I said earlier when I said Arizona's blue. You know, certainly at the federal level it is, but lower, you know, at the state level and more locally, it is not. And there's a lot of work to be done. But, you know, I think there's a lot of factors that went into this. I mean, turnout, you know, on the Republican side was very high. I mean, Republicans activated, you know, low propensity voters at a pretty high level. At least that's all by all indications what we've seen, just like Democrats usually do. So I think, you know, in rural districts in the legislature, it was very much an uphill climb for Democrats. And so that made it difficult. But overall, I mean, it's certainly surprising the outcomes and, you know, disappointing in some ways. And, you know, what I fear going into the legislature next year is that it seems as though You know, with Democrats in minority, the Republican majority caucus has gotten even more conservative. And so I sort of wonder what that's going to look like when it comes to any chance of, you know, bipartisan cooperation.
Roy, why do you think it is that Democrats did so well at the federal level, maybe not extending all the way down to Congress, but at the legislative level, the county level, Republicans still really dominated there?
Well, you know, I think what is important to note in a lot of these races, both, you know, locally and at the state level, is that the races were all really close. So it's not as if, you know, Democrats lost by a ton. Many of these races were very, very close. And, you know, some of them were even going to be decided by hundreds of votes. What I think it shows is that there is still a shift. I still believe that there's a shift towards, you know, a more purple kind of state, towards having Democrats be competitive in many districts here. But perhaps we're just not quite there yet. And it's going to take another election cycle or two for that to occur. But there has been some shifts. I mean, we are at a 29-31 House, for example, in the legislature. So, you know, it's a matter of getting that extra point or two to win these races. You know, and again, it was disappointing it didn't happen this year, but I do think it's eventually going to happen. And there's going to be, you know, you mentioned the money that was spent. There's going to be a lot more money spent in 2022 and 2024 and so on and so forth from on the Democratic side to try to get Democrats elected.
Lauren, not to get too ahead of ourselves, but we know redistricting is around the corner. How do you think that affects how things go forward? Because certainly Republicans felt like during the last cycle they were not aggressive enough. And if we see that shift and more attention paid to that, this may have been the Democrats' last chance for a while to actually claim the legislature.
Oh, I 100% agree that the Democrats missed their opportunity for a while to flip both chambers of the House. And in all honesty, they were pretty confident for the past 6 to 9 months about how they were going to do that, and, you know, talking about their leadership decisions, et cetera. The reason why I think Democrats did not do well, especially in Maricopa County, was that there was this overall assumption that these Republicans that were going to support Joe Biden over Donald Trump, that were going to support Mark Kelly over Martha McSally, which we know there's quite a few of them, were going to all of a sudden vote Democrat the entire ballot. And I've been saying for months that is 100% inaccurate. Just because you have Republicans that are anti-Trump or anti-Martha McSally does not mean that all of a sudden they're Democrats and that they're wholeheartedly endorsing a Democrat agenda. And so, I mean, Democrats need to figure out what their message is moving forward, especially if they want to attract, you know, Republican-leaning independents and moderate Republicans. And it's not with the message that a number of these local candidates were talking about, with very progressive stances and ideology and agendas. That's Arizona is not blue. If we want to say we're purplish, that's great. But if you're talking about these reforms and agenda items that are going to really impact Arizona families in a negative way, you're not going to get the support. So I do think with redistricting and Republicans learning the, you know, the lesson from 2010, Republicans are going to be a lot more aggressive this go around. And so I'm confident that moving forward, Republicans, you know, and these local races are going to continue to do well.
Lorna, we've seen this at the federal level when certain candidates are targeted, let's say, because they're maybe easier targets for Democrats to knock off or whatever it may have been. So we saw, as Mark mentioned, the one Senate seat that switched, Christine Marsh for Kate Brophy McGee. It would be, I think, an exaggeration to say Kate Brophy McGee is a moderate, but she's certainly a moderate in today's environment. And now, so in some sense, the Democrats have lost a Republican they could occasionally work with. How does that affect things when either party sort of targets the so-called moderates, and then when that moderate's gone, it's basically what the numbers are, because you're not going to see someone shift even for certain issues, maybe?
Yeah, the problem with targeting the moderates in any direction is that you tend to have an outcome where you have a more polarized legislature. So you have those on the far left that get elected and those on the far right. And then you start losing those people in the middle, like you said, that are actually willing to work with their colleagues on the other side of the aisle to get something done for the state. And so someone like Kate Brophy McGee is a prime example, who worked with Democrat colleagues and Republican colleagues on K-12 education funding, on child safety reform, on, you know, kids care, et cetera. These issues that are really important to Democrats, they had an ally in the Republican caucus that would lead the charge to get her colleagues on board. And so to target her just so they can add one more D, okay, great for them. They have another D on the board. But when you're going to need a Republican crossover or a group of individuals that you can work with, and now you're just going to target them and boot them out of office, you're really losing an important element of bipartisanship down at the legislature. And it wasn't just Kate Brophy McGee is the one who unfortunately lost the race. But if you look at the other Maricopa County districts that Democrats really targeted, these were individuals who have a history of working with their colleagues across the aisle to get things done. And luckily, they were successful in their races. But I mean, it's just an interesting strategy. But I don't think overall it's helpful for the people of Arizona when it creates a more polarized legislature.
Roy, I'm curious about what you think the dynamics will be down there. And obviously we're a few months away from the next session. You mentioned that, you know, some of the Republicans, you know, might be a more conservative legislature. We also saw Heather Carter, who is a Republican who often worked with Democrats, or at least occasionally worked with Democrats. She lost her primary race, not even making it to the general election. Do you have any measure of optimism that there can be bipartisanship at the Capitol coming up in 2021?
Well, I think it's going to be tough. I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, this is kind of the conversation here has been, you know, kind of doom and gloom on the Democratic side. And I, like I said, you know, I do think that there has been there's been some disappointment. I mean, certainly the expectations were higher, but we're at an interesting place as a state. And I'll get back to your bipartisan question in a sec. But, you know, in the same election, we saw 207 and 208 pass. I mean, in 208 in particular, which was something that, you know, the sort of Republican and business establishment was against, ended up passing here. So it's just kind of, I don't know, I guess an interesting place where we're seeing progressive policies still pass, but then perhaps not the candidates win. But back to your question, I think that, you know, it is going to be difficult because, as I mentioned earlier, the caucus, especially in, let's say, the state Senate for the Republicans, has gotten significantly more conservative. And so is there going to be any impetus there to negotiate with the other side? You know, the House may be different because the, you know, the margin there is so small, you just need one, you know, one person to negotiate on the Republican side. So maybe that happens. And there are a lot of issues, I'm hopeful anyways, on issues like infrastructure and on healthcare, and even on COVID relief, that we actually get some bipartisan issues done. And back to my first point, since 208 passed, it's very, you know, I'm very curious, since education funding has been the number one issue down there for so long, you know, where does that leave sort of the education debate since we have passed 208?
Lorna, we've got about 30 seconds. Can you comment on 208? Do you think that's going to have an impact?
Well, one, I found it extremely disappointing, obviously, that Prop 208 passed. And I do think, even though that there was an effort from the No campaign to defeat it at the ballot, it's really hard when you're talking to the general public about K-12 education funding, especially in the environment that we're in right now with the coronavirus and everyone really struggling to get by and seeing what's happening with our K-12 education system. And so that's not really a surprise. What the lasting impacts are going to be, though, of Prop 208 is going to be devastating to the state of Arizona. And I think that's what people are going to start to realize in the coming years, that as we're trying to regenerate our economy after, you know, COVID-19, and Arizona becomes a flyover state because we're in the top 10 for the highest income tax rates in the nation, and people are wondering why we're not having the job growth or creation that we did for the past 10 years, I think we'll all be able to pinpoint Prop 208 as the reason why.
Roy, I'm going to give you 10 seconds on that one.
Well, I mean, I obviously disagree. I think a lot of the statements about Prop 208 mirror the concerns that the business community had about the minimum wage increase, and nothing occurred there. So I voted for it, and I'm happy it passed, but we'll see what happens.
Attorney and former congressional staffer Roy Herrera and Lorna Romero, owner of Elevate Strategies. Great to have you both with us. Take care. Thanks.